Welcome back to the program. We've talked many times about human beings' resistance to change. Perhaps in large part, this comes from a fundamental flaw in our brains. That is that the world around us, our culture, our technology, our information, and work, are all moving at a tremendously rapid pace. On the other hand, evolution moves very, very slowly. And our brains, which must process all that is happening around us, are still based on an operating system from a very different time, almost a primitive time. And while our brains have 90 billion neurons and over 100 trillion synapses, it's simply not designed for a 21st century world. And trying to reconcile this, our brains often crash as they try to cope with this expanse of modernity. We're going to talk about this today with my guest, Dean Buonomano. He's a professor in the Department of Neurobiology and Psychology at the Brain Research Institute at UCLA. His research has been funded by the National Institute of Health and the National Science Foundation. It is my pleasure to welcome him here today to talk about his newest book, Brain Bugs, How the Brain's Flaws Shape Our Lives. Dean Buonomano, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me, Jeff. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great to have you here. Talk about this disconnect, first of all, between the modern world and things that we have to deal with and cope with and process every day versus the reality of our brains, which really were set up for a very primitive culture and in many ways still carry within its software many of the things that are applicable to that more primitive time.
Well, that's exactly a good way to frame that. It's important to remember that the brain is a type of a computer, right? It's certainly very, very different from a digital computer. But in the end, we take input through our sensory organs and generate our behaviors. And there's a lot of really cool stuff in between there, consciousness, awareness, creativity, love, intelligence. But in the end, the brain was designed, if you will, by the evolutionary process to help us navigate a world that's very different from the one we currently live in, one in which we had to make decisions as to what animals were poisonous, where to find food, who to trust, who our enemies and friends were, where to find water. And amazingly, we've built a world so dramatically different from that one of millions of years ago, one in which we have radio programs, where we're transmitting signals through satellites, where we're transplanting organs from one individual to the next, and where we're very rich in the number in numerical calculations and numbers, which are very unnatural for us. So we've currently living in a world that it's safe to say that we were not programmed to live in, and there's consequences on that. And if I may give a consequence in the animal kingdom,
sure,
that I think is easy for people to comprehend, if you think of a skunk, and a skunk has this beautiful defense mechanism against enemies, which is just to turn around, lift its tail, and spray, and that's has done it very well, evolutionarily speaking, unless the threat is a car, then that's a rather inappropriate or tragic defense mechanism. So because it's simply not programmed to deal with that threat. And we weren't designed, if you will, or optimized, perhaps I should say, to deal with a numbers-rich world with digital age in which there's a very high population density, where there's an abundance of food and so forth. So I'm referring to the glitches, flaws, and limitations of the brain as the brain's bugs, and they have a variety of consequences in our life.
At the core of this is this difference between kind of symbolic manipulation, which is, you know, what most of us do most of the time, and pattern recognition, which is really what our brains were set up to do. And this disconnect between the two, the conflict between the two sometimes, is what brings out many of these bugs that you talk about.
Yes, so it was very important during evolution to recognize a snake or a poisonous snake, not necessarily how many snakes were there in front of us. So numerical calculations or number systems are something that are very recent, right? And in the past, in some cultures, some native cultures still don't have numerical systems that count very high. So we use symbols to develop the ability to count and keep track of baseball scores or salaries or budget deficits. And that's in contrast with pattern recognition and the building blocks of our brain. these are the neurons and the synapses that you mentioned, are very well suited for pattern recognition because each neuron in our brain communicates with thousands of others, and it's very well suited to capture the whole from the sum of the parts because they're communicating to neurons near and far. But that's not necessarily the best way to process numbers. So I think a good example of what you just mentioned in terms of symbolic calculations is something where related to our strange interaction with time. So if I say, Jeff, what do you prefer, $100 now or $120 in a month from now? Now, most people take the $100 now, but merely phrasing that question requires symbolic representations of the future of what 1 month is and what $100 is. If I had asked you, well, what do you want now, one apple or today or two apples in a month from now? It makes sense to go for the apple now if you're hungry, but with the money, since we're thinking long-term in the future, it probably makes more sense to wait the month for $120 because 20% is a good yield. But that effect means that we don't generally make good long-term decisions. We at least hampered a bit in our ability to balance the short-term with the long-term. Because of our immediate gratification bias.
Right, and that immediate gratification bias is kind of hardwired into us, into the brain software as it has evolved.
Absolutely, and it makes sense, right? Because for most animals, including early man, the priority was always short-term survival. It was very unnatural to have to think about retirement plans or credit card expenses years from now. So it's no surprise that we have a strong built-in immediate gratification bias because it's important for survival. We should pick the food now over more food sometime in the future. But we've developed or built a world around us in which many of the problems we face are long-term, whether it's environmental, health, financial, as I said, budget issues. And so I think this, to a degree, impairs optimal behavior because we really did evolve to not have to cope or not have to be optimized to make long-term decisions.
And this also relates to something else you spend a lot of time talking about, which is how the brain processes time, how time relates to this kind of associative architecture of the brain.
Right. So this is a fascinating question and one that we don't have all the answers to, but when a clock on your wrist, it's an amazing device that we've managed to build because it can tell both milliseconds and months and years, right? Now, the brain also tells time across very different scales, but it doesn't have one clock. There's no central clock that we have. And the part of your brain that tells you when to go to bed doesn't have a second hand. And the part of the brain that tells you when the red light is about to change doesn't have an hour hand. So there's, if you will, loosely speaking, different clocks in our head, and none of them are that accurate. So we always have some distortions of how we tell time. And there's also evidence that when we think about the future, it's sort of miss. If I ask you, well, think about 3 months or 6 months ahead of time, you don't necessarily think of 6 months as being double the amount of time as 3 months. Of course, you know that the number six is double the number of three, but when you're sort of asked to represent that in a graph, for example, we tend to think that 6 months is less than 3 months, is less than double of 3 months. So how we code time and how we tell time probably influences how we cope with long-term decisions.
Right. And how does our own kind of biological clock fit into this equation with respect to, for example, night and day and the fact that we may wake up at the same time every day or be hungry at the same time every day?
So that's the biological clock that we refer to, the circadian clock, that takes care of our daily activities, as you just said, that tells us when to go to bed and when we're hungry. And that one we actually know a fair amount about how it works. And because what's interesting there is we're not the only animals to have it, of course. Of course, other animals have it. But even plants can keep track of the time of day. And this seems to be a biochemical clock that in which proteins, and this is not that relevant to the story, but proteins are made during the day and then they're degraded at night, and that the concentration of certain proteins provides information about time. What's interesting about that is that that's also responsible for jet lag, right?
Mm-hmm.
When we travel to Europe, that clock we can't reset. And it's interesting to remember how unnatural that is. In hundreds of millions of years of evolution, probably no creature has ever traveled halfway across the globe in a question of hours. So there was never any pressure to reset the biological clock quickly. And that's one of the consequences, is jet lag. Now that we've developed the technology that allows us to do cross-continental travel, we're stuck with a clock that can't be easily reset. And that's why we're often suffer jet lag.
How does the brain process this in terms of the context of language versus a visual context or a sort of pattern recognition context? Because language is the additional thing that we bring to it.
So when we're talking about I like to think as the basic architecture of the brain, which we refer to as the associative architecture of the brain, and this is that the brain stores information by the connections, by the links, and information is stored by which groups of neurons are connected to which. And as I said, because neurons are computational building blocks that are so extroverted and social, there's a lot of crosstalk between the auditory or the language parts of the brain and the visual. So a nice example is if I say, Johnny fell off the wagon. Now, if you and I are standing in a bar, you are likely to interpret that sentence to mean one thing. But if you and I are standing in a playground, you're likely to interpret that in a much more benign manner. And that's because the brain is exquisitely capable, and this is something computers don't do very well, is to pick up context. Because we've created all these associations, the word fell off the wagon, we've associated with either starting to drink again in one context or just on a toy wagon in another context, because everything is connected to each other. So an example here, can we do a quick example?
Sure, go ahead.
So if I asked you to answer two questions, and they're not trick questions, I just say, in what continent is Kenya?
Africa.
And what are the two opposing colors in the game of chess?
Black and white.
And now I say, think of any animal.
Well, zebra would come immediately to mind.
And thank you for playing along, by the way. But the truth is, there's a lot of people will think of an animal from Africa, and many will think of zebra. Not everybody, of course. But why is that? It's simply because the brain stores information through links. So somehow the neurons in our brain that represent zebra are somehow connected to the neurons in our brain that represent black and white or represent Africa. And this is a fundamental principle in neuroscience, and it's often phrased as neurons that fire together wire together. So somehow they become connected to each other, sort of in the same way that web pages that...
Right, it's like hyperlinks.
It's exactly like hyperlinks, and people link pages on the web that are connected to each other. So the brain somehow figures that out to do that in a self-organizing manner, and that's what we learn. And we're always learning. We're always making associations throughout our whole life. It's hard not to. If two things are presented together, it's hard not to pay attention to those associations and to pick them up unconsciously.
But there's a kind of uncertainty principle that goes with this, as you talk about the storage and retrieval system of the brain, which has an impact on the information or the memories themselves.
Exactly. So this is a related issue that's not quite directly a cause of the associative architecture. So this is a very important point that I like sort of expressing, again, with an analogy with a computer. So if you have a DVD and you have a DVD burner, that DVD burner has a laser that will burn holes in the reflective surface. So that's writing information. Now, reading in that information is actually done by a different laser. So the write operation, the storage, and the retrieval operation are done separately. There's really no chance that one is going to interfere with the other. Now, this is not the case in the brain. The storage and retrieval information are not that distinct, and this has a number of effects in real life. And I discuss one in the book, which is the case of an eyewitness testimony trial in which a woman, her name is Jennifer Thompson, and she was raped. And during her ordeal, she made an effort to try to memorize the face of her assailant. Later on that day, she was shown a photo lineup, and she picked an individual that was eventually sent to prison for life. It later became clear through a long process that took 11 years that that was not the correct individual. And it's a very touching story, and she has a book out that came out a few years ago called Picking Cotton, which she wrote with the person that actually she accused of, and together they tried to change the way eyewitness testimony was performed. But the point is that the way the brain works, and this is a bit of a brain bug, is that when we're retrieving something, we're also storing something. And the act of seeing somebody or picking somebody out, you're also updating your image and making a new memory that can overwrite the old one. So if you see your cousin every 6 months, you don't have a fixed photographic memory of him every 6 months. You update your memory of him every 6 months, and maybe he's wearing glasses, his hair is a bit longer, he has a beard, his hair color has changed. So every time you see, you retrieve who that person is, you're also updating that. And that's a wonderful feature, right? Unless you're trying to identify somebody in an eyewitness account, in which you can end up updating your original memory with a totally new person altogether. So that, in that sense, it's a brain bug.
How does what we refer to as intelligence fit into this equation?
Well, that's a tricky question, Jeff. And intelligence is, I think, an ill-defined word in my mind. It's a bit like beauty. Beauty can mean very different things to different people. So there's certainly, scientists have measures of intelligence with standardized tests, but there's a big debate about how well those really correlate with ability to make important discoveries or to manage the country or to be a good doctor. So certainly there's strong correlations there. But in my view, intelligence is really it's a bit like sports aptitude, right? You can have a good athlete that's a great basketball player but not a good gymnast, and vice versa. Mm-hmm. So there's certainly, we all agree certain people are good athletes and we all agree people are intelligent. But I think it's really, what we really mean is multiple things there. Intelligence has components of having a good memory, of being having a lot of knowledge already stored, of solving problems, having good intuition. And I think, in my opinion, and people will argue this, it's something we don't fully understand in part because of its complexity.
Right. And you talk about intuition, because part of that whole process of what we might consider intelligence is this balance between what you refer to as kind of the automatic system, the intuitive system, and the more deliberative systems of the brain.
Right. And so that's another great point, really. So people can understand this. It's useful to give examples. If I ask the old trick question, what do cows drink? The part of your brain that just thought of milk is what we think of as the automatic system. and then the part of your brain that says, whoa, 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 it's water, that's the reflective system. And in the most part, we're just loosely defining this, of course, that our decisions are a result of these two interacting systems, loosely speaking, the automatic and the reflective. The automatic is very, as the name implies, is associative, somewhat more emotional and very quick and unconscious. So you think of milk because cow is associated with milk and milk is a drink, and that's automatic. That's the first thing that probably popped into your head. The reflective system is slow. It requires deliberation and conscious thought. And that's the one that we should probably tap into when we're making important decisions, as, well, what do we want to buy? Who do we want to vote for? Is this the best option for my job? But it does seem to be the case that our automatic system often influences us in negative ways because we're not aware of it. And this brings us back to the associative architecture of the brain. So a typical example would be have to make a tough medical decision, and you're told that one of your options is a surgical option that has a 95% survival rate. Then you're told, well, there's also this radiotherapy option that has a 5% mortality rate. Okay, 95% survival, 5% mortality, same thing. But because one was phrased or framed in terms of survival, and that's something that portrays optimism as being positive, it turns out that people are biased towards that option simply because of the way the information is presented. And, of course, this is used continuously in marketing and political advertising by just being careful to frame things in a positive way so that we'll unconsciously sway or prime our opinions or decisions with a desired outcome. So that automatic system is contributing to our sensitivity to some of these what we call cognitive biases.
Right.
That can alter, prevent us from making rational decisions.
And, of course, the overlay to all of this, I suppose, is that we are still constantly evolving and constantly adapting.
Well, so that's a tricky question. So in my opinion, I would not say we're still evolving in the traditional sense. We're certainly adapting, but in the traditional evolutionary sense, it's not clear if we're still evolving, because we evolve over hundreds of thousands of years and through selective pressures. And because we've been so successful in our technological achievements, it's a tricky question to answer to what degree we're still evolving. We're certainly adapting, and that's something that is just a signature of the human brain. It's really, what I find amazing is perhaps not so much that we have bugs, but that we've made it as far as we have, that we've built a world of incredible complexity and so successful, where we've cured diseases and to a large degree contained nature and been successful in feeding billions of people. So we adapt and we have cultural transmission and we can recognize our bugs. And we can do some debugging, right? Because from the smartphones that store our numbers, or from the fact that our cars beep at us when we forget the lights on, to the fact that we treat our phobias with medical or therapy options, and that we can sit down and think about a problem and try to grasp what our flaws are and try to overcome those. So I think that's how we adapt, and that's a truly impressive part of the brain as a computational device, its ability to adapt. But that doesn't mean it's easy, and we have to be aware of our flaws and bugs.
And in many ways, the technology that we have developed is technology that helps us, that aids us in making these adaptations, and arguably slows down the need to evolve, because the technology itself just allows the system as it currently exists to adapt.
So in a way, it is a handicap, right? So we're horrible. It's a way to defeat or combat our handicaps, right? So we're horrible at numerical calculations. No human being can calculate the natural logarithm of a 10-digit number. So what we've done is we've developed these very sophisticated artificial computational devices that does that for us. So it's an impressive solution to sort of build upon our weaknesses so that we can compensate them. And you're right, that's what we do, is a lot of our technology is developed around our inherent weaknesses, whether we recognize it or not. But of course, in some cases, our weaknesses are exploited. In the cases of advertising, where one of the most tragically successful marketing campaigns in history was the cigarette marketing, which was associated with the death of hundreds of million people last century. So certainly some of our bugs can be exploited against our own best interests by tapping into our desire, our associative architecture of brain, by associating cigarettes with pretty successful people, or by encouraging us to imitate things for marketing purposes. So it goes both ways, and the more we're aware of how they can be exploited, certainly the better off our decisions will likely be.
Dean Buonomano, the book is Brain Bugs, How the Brain's Flaws Shape Our Lives. Dean, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Jeff, it was a very fun conversation. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.